Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Well, that was discouraging, wasn't it? The November jobs report, I mean. What November 2010 might tell us about the economic future? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, helping doctors, lawyers, and small business owners monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. ReputationDefender.com. And by Toyota. Toyota is sharing technology and ideas for a better world. Learn more at toyota.com/ideas for good.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 3rd of December. Great to have you with us. But if you were hoping for some good jobs news today, maybe to give to your unemployed spouse or your recent college graduate child, yeah, the one still living in his old room, well, today just wasn't that day. The November employment report was a downer in pretty much every direction. We added only 39,000 jobs last month. Economists had gotten our hopes up for a much bigger jump. And to top it all off, the unemployment rate went up a couple of ticks as well to 9.8%. That's the biggest number we've seen in that category since April. And as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, big numbers like that might be around for a while.
Every economist I reached today was surprised by just how lousy job growth was.
There is something odd about the November release.
Bernard Baumol is with the Economic Outlook Group.
The November report was stunning in just how depressing the job market is. It's wholly inconsistent with what we have seen in other data.
Data like increasing consumer spending and manufacturing activity. But smooth out those statistical ups and downs in the employment report, and we'd still need 50,000 more jobs a month just to keep up with the normal growth in the workforce, not to mention re-employ people laid off in the recession. Which is why Chris Varvaras at Macroeconomic Advisors predicts the unemployment rate will remain stubbornly high.
We still don't breach the 9% level until sometime in 2012.
That's still nowhere near what we used to think of as normal, full employment, only 5% of people looking for work. Plus, the search for jobs is about to get more desperate as millions of people run out of extended federal unemployment benefits. Denver resident Dana Parker's checks stop next week. Until now, she hasn't looked at minimum wage or temp jobs.
I will look harder for things like that. I don't know how I could possibly be looking any harder, but I will consider part-time work.
She'll be competing in a market where there are still around 5 job seekers for every available, even low-paying, job. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The real story of the vote today by the President's Commission on the Deficit wasn't about the actual vote. Noses had already been counted. Everybody pretty much knew the thing wasn't going to go to Congress intact. But that doesn't mean lawmakers won't be talking about some of the Commission's recommendations, as Marketplace's David Gura reports.
They called their plan the moment of truth, a proposal to overhaul the tax code, raise the retirement age, and slash defense spending. Before the vote, the real moment of truth, Alan Simpson, the commission's co-chair, had this to say.
Whether we get 2 votes or 18, this baby ain't going away.
It might get buried in an unmarked grave, he said. But when Congress has to vote on the next budget,
this cadaver will rise from the crypt.
Some spookiness there from the folksy former senator. But there is consensus the commissioners want to keep talking.
The conversation is actually going on right now.
Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky didn't vote for the plan. She says it unfairly burdens the middle class. But she believes the commission did a good job tackling a tough issue.
It certainly has, in a constructive way, opened up the discussion of an unsustainable fiscal path that we're on, and I think pointed out many ways that we can address that.
For the first time in a long time, what was once considered untouchable is up for discussion, from Medicare to tax deductions. Commissioner Alice Rivlin voted for the proposal. She says she's looking forward to meeting with Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner and the White House Budget Director.
I think the president must take leadership and get his own plan on the table in his budget and then work out compromises with the House and the Senate so that something happens.
Rivlin says something has to. And soon. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Traders squeaked out a win at the bell on Wall Street today after sulking all day about that jobs report. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Time to do that thing we do on a Friday afternoon, wrap up the week on Wall Street and beyond. Here to do that with us are John Carney from CNBC, also Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. Lee, John, good to talk to you both again.
Good to be here, Kai.
Thanks for having us.
So we're going to use the jobs numbers, obviously, to start off today, but we're going to go to sort of the politics of it and not the economics of it that Mitchell Hartman talked about up at the top of the broadcast. John, is this number today going to change the political discussion about whether or not to extend jobless benefits?
Early on, I expected it would, but the discussion so far has actually gone in exactly the way it was going before. There are a lot of people who think that the extending the jobs benefits is actually increasing unemployment by discouraging people to work. That argument has already resurfaced again today. I don't frankly buy that at all. I think the idea that people are preferring to be jobless and get unemployment benefits rather than go to work is a myth. There's just not a lot of jobs out there.
Yeah. So, Lee, cast your mind down Washington way and give me your sense.
This number was really unexpected. The question is it a blip or a trend? It's going to be used for everything down in D.C. as we are seeing. I mean, the political football is just ridiculous, and this is really going to be the new show. I mean, the fight over tax cuts, I think, is just the beginning.
All right. Let's take a break from the news of the day, as it were, and talk about sort of the bigger economic picture. The news this week that the Federal Reserve released all those documents on Wednesday. We now know who borrowed how much and at what times. Here's the thing, though, John. Much as the WikiLeaks cables about the State Department showed that our diplomats say nasty things about other countries, does it matter that we know that Goldman Sachs went to the Fed 84 times?
I think it matters in that it showed us how severe the financial crisis really got, that even relatively healthy banks had to depend on the Fed for funding in late 2008. And I think that is a good reminder that things really, really, really were awful. And the measures that the Fed took allowed these banks to actually stay alive. It's very clear, for instance, from the numbers that Morgan Stanley was dead. They borrowed so heavily from the Fed's facilities because there was no other way for them to continue to operate.
Lee, what about that?
Well, the other interesting thing about that data dump is that it really also drove home how it was not just the banks. It was companies like Verizon and Harley Davidson and GE. And, we knew back then that the commercial paper market had frozen up, but most people don't really know what that means. What we see now in black and white is that meant that, you know, companies like Harley Davidson couldn't make their payroll and needed to tap those facilities.
Let me leave off this week with something David Gura talked about right up at the top of the broadcast briefly, the deficit commission. Are either of you confident that we're going to get something fixing the deficit before it gets much, much worse, John?
Oh, I'm not confident at all. You've got, you know, one side that wants to cut taxes, the other side that's unwilling to cut any spending. I think that what we'll end up with is declining revenue by cutting taxes while we keep on spending. I don't think the deficit commission is really going to accomplish very much of anything.
Lee?
You know, people don't lie awake at night, regular people thinking about the deficit. They think about how they're going to put food on their plate and what kind of job they're going to get. And I think until we solve those issues, anything else is maybe not as important.
All right, I lied. I said I was going to end with the deficit commission, but I'm not. Lee, let me throw this out at you for a second. The idea that the labor market is actually stuck, and what we now have is that jobless recovery that we were talking about 6 or 8 months ago, and the fears of the double-dip recession might return. What do you think?
Well, I don't think we're actually at risk for a double-dip recession. If you look at some of the fundamentals, they actually really are improving. I was actually out in Silicon Valley this week. The pace and the startup boom out there is really, it's really impressive, and that's, you know, grounds for optimism.
I think that businesses have gone on strike, basically. They are not expanding. They have tons of cash, but they're not using that to build out new operations or hire new people. So we are stuck with a jobless recovery for a long time, and that's going to mean a lot of pain all across the country, except maybe in pockets where things are going pretty well, like New York City or Silicon Valley.
John Carney from CNBC and his blog NetNet. Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks for having us.
The reports of all the horrible violence of Mexico's drug war can pass you by pretty easily if you let them, unless you stop for a second and imagine that it's news from your country or from your hometown. This week, a female police chief was killed after only 2 months on the job. A 14-year-old hitman was arrested today, 14 years old, charged with beheading four people. 3 years after the drug wars started in earnest, thousands of Mexicans have left the country. That includes business owners who've moved across the border north to El Paso, Texas. Monica Ortiz Uribe reports that the corporate transition into the United States isn't so easy.
It's a Thursday morning at a Chinese restaurant in El Paso. Men wearing ties stand around in clusters, laughing and patting each other on the back.
Órale, gracias.
This is the weekly meeting of La Red, or The Network. The members are mostly Mexican business owners who fled the violence in Ciudad Juarez.
Everybody knows why everybody else is here. No one talks about it. Nobody asks anything because we already know.
Alfredo Trabulsi has an online marketing business. He says if you were to ask, you'd hear horrible stories. One member escaped his own kidnapping. Others know colleagues, friends, and loved ones who were murdered.
Échale.
At a furniture showroom in El Paso, a business owner radios his workers back in Juarez. The owner doesn't want to give too many details about himself for his own safety. He fled Juarez 4 months ago, convinced that his life was in danger. Now he monitors the furniture factory in Juarez through 16 surveillance cameras.
I used to work in my office 7 in the morning till 12 noon, and then I go to the plant and check everything myself. And now I check the cameras all day long. I have 4 months watching TV.
The distance complicates things that used to be simple. For example, creating a new couch design.
When I make a new frame, I used to do it in one day. Now it takes almost a week.
He started his company 27 years ago. Many of his original workers are still with him. Now he must decide whether to move the factory from Juarez to El Paso.
I'm learning how to make business here is different. It's a lot of difference to run a business in Mexico and the United States.
He must consider things like tax laws, worker benefits, and wages before making the move. For Mexican businesses already established in El Paso, life is a little easier. It's an hour before the dinner rush at Maria Chuchena restaurant in West El Paso. The popular chain was founded by three brothers in Ciudad Juarez. Business there has been bad in the last 3 years. Omar Herrera is the youngest of the brothers.
Sales went down pretty harshly because of the violence. We had to close one of the restaurants that we had in Juarez because of it.
Having a restaurant in El Paso gives the brothers a peace of mind, and that's exactly what most business owners fleeing across the border need. Having a network of colleagues who understand their predicament only contributes to that peace of mind. Back at La Red Gathering, busboys are clearing off the tables as the meeting comes to an end. The organization has grown quickly. In 8 months, the group went from 6 members to 200. José Luis Mauricio Esparza is the president of La Red. He moved his publishing business to El Paso 13 years ago and is one of the advisors who helps newcomers make the transition from Mexico to the United States. Mauricio says the switch is as much about culture as it is about logistics.
When I go out for a lunch meeting in El Paso, it takes me half an hour. It's yes or no business. When I do a business meeting in Juarez, it takes me 2 to 3 hours because we go out and have lunch. After a few tequilas, we talk, we get to know each other more. So you have to be aware that the way we do business is different.
Mauricio says in a way, his members are fortunate. They have more options than most people in Mexico for escaping the violence. As border residents, many were born in El Paso but lived all their life in Juarez, so they have the benefit of dual citizenship.
All of us like to learn new things. And this is the opportunity for us to know and develop a new sense of entrepreneurship mentality.
Like any good business owner, Mauricio believes in seizing every new opportunity, even if it's a result of a tragedy. In El Paso, I'm Monica Ortiz Uribe for Marketplace.
Coming up, what happens when a cynic talks to a toy store guy?
I think you're Scrooge.
Yeah, that'd be me. A conversation from the corner office at Toys R Us. But first, let's do the numbers. A decent day, a very decent week. The Dow Industrials added another 19 points, a 10th percent, closed at 11,382. The NASDAQ gained just under 0.5%, 12 points, 2591. The number, The S&P 500 took home 0.25%, 3 points, ended the day and the week at 1224. For the week, and it was the best in a month, the Dow jumped 2.6%. The NASDAQ grew 2.2%. The S&P 500 advanced 3% even. Bank of America put on 1.5%. Today, JPMorgan Chase popped 0.75% higher. Citigroup added 0.67%. Tech stocks were mixed even as the NASDAQ approaches a three-year high. Microsoft chipped up 0.5%. Google put on 0.25%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to, wait for it, 3.01%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Meritas, a worldwide alliance of law firms committed to helping business owners and in-house counsel find local, pre-qualified legal counsel for over 20 years. Meritas.org. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and Progressive.com. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, U.S. Census Bureau Director Robert Groves discusses the 2010 demographic analysis. Representatives from Iran, the five permanent members of the U.N. Security Council, and Germany gather in Geneva for 2 days. Discussions are expected to focus on Iran's nuclear program. And comedian Stephen Wright turns 55. Happy birthday. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Scattered clouds and intermittent storms all week in the weather this week in Cancun, Mexico. Not quite what the tens of thousands of people in town for the UN climate conference were probably expecting. The more predictable forecast was all the usual indoor bluster. At the end of the first week of meetings, though, there does seem to be some agreement on one part of the climate conundrum. Who's going to pay to help poor countries cope? From the press room down in Cancun, Marketplace's Yves Tro reports.
$100 billion. That's how much wealthy nations have agreed to pay poorer nations to reduce carbon pollution and fight problems they're already having due to climate change. A UN committee says it could raise $20 billion by taxing emissions on air travel and shipping.
There's a win-win to be had.
That's Timothy Gore with the nonprofit Oxfam. He says international air and shipping are not bound by current UN climate agreements, and they give off about 8% of yearly greenhouse gas emissions, and growing.
You can address those emissions, but you can do it in a way which also raises finance, and a quite substantive finance.
Planes and boats are complicated to tax because they pollute as they cross national borders. That's one reason their emissions haven't been regulated globally. But Nancy Young with the Air Transport Association says air and shipping haven't had a free pass. Other UN agencies already oversee them on climate change. And she says airlines have made big promises.
From 2020, we've committed to carbon neutral growth and an aspirational target of a 50% reduction in our emissions by 2050.
You can see those goals on a huge billboard by the Cancun airport. Young says they'll cost a lot. Adding a new UN tax
will really take away from our ability to invest in the very things that we're doing to improve our greenhouse gas emissions.
She says the tax would cost airlines up to $6 billion by 2020. The global airline industry is expected to earn about $9 billion in profits this year. In Cancun, I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Of all the places you might want to be 3 weeks before Christmas, trying to get a sense of the American economy, the world's biggest toy store really isn't a bad choice. At noon on a Wednesday at the Toys R Us in Times Square in New York City, the place, well, it's packed. Talking dolls, a mini space-age motorcycle that drives up walls, and a big plastic Buzz Lightyear complete with jetpack and permagrin. Toys R Us used to be the number one toy retailer in the country. It pioneered the idea of big box stores selling high volume at low prices. Today, Walmart and Target do the same thing, but they do it better, which leaves Toys R Us with the tricky job of stealing back customers from the best in the retail business.
The boss will see you now.
So today on Conversations from the Corner Office, Toys R Us CEO Jerry Storch on exactly how he's going to do that.
Well, we have a lot of respect for our competitors, but principally they are limited assortment discount chains. There is no confusion when you ask our customers, why do you come to Toys R Us? They come because we have more toys and we're in stock on the toys. That's why you come to any specialty player in retail.
But here's the thing. This is an amazing store. It's got a four-story Ferris wheel. It's got a roaring dinosaur in the background. It's got everything you'd want in a toy store. This is not, though, your typical Toys R Us. When I go to the one near me in Burbank, it's disheveled looking. The staff is less than completely well-trained. It's not always the most pleasant experience, and you hear those stories over and over again. What do you do with those stores of yours who don't meet the code?
Well, first of all, let me tell you, we have 25 million children a year visit Toys R Us. And if you have one or two children and you need to clean up after them, you might have some idea what it's like when you have 25 million children visiting your place. So we do a lot of work to keep our stores nice. But meanwhile, we're working to renovate all our stores, and we're about a third of the way through the chain. And they still have the reality that you've got millions of kids going through these stores.
So here's the cynic in me, right? Nobody needs anything that's in this store. You don't have to have anything that's in this store.
To me, I think that it's one of the greatest necessities in life is toys for your children. Certainly, fun in and of itself is enough of a reason, but there's study after study after study showing that children learn from their toys. You don't know how many times I'll go and visit with executives of a major American corporation or with politicians or doctors, and they start talking about the role that toys played in their childhood and in their development. They remember, to a person, the toys they played with and the influence they had on them. A toy is not trousers. A toy is not tomatoes. This is not a commodity.
The toy market, though, is sales are shrinking, right? Sales are down. They have kids have more options these days. There's electronic this and gadget that. And in my house, if I bought an iPad, I would never have to buy another toy. I mean, there's so many distractions for kids. How do you get them to the old-fashioned sit on the floor and play with this toy point?
Well, toys are not shrinking. The toy market has been growing now. Kids love toys. Last year's hot toy was Juju Pets. It was a little hamster.
You're the guy to blame for three of those in my house?
Well, you could get more than that. You know, it wasn't a computer. It was a hamster. So we sell iPods. But meanwhile, lots of kids want, you know, a stuffed animal, too. Or Dance Star Mickey is one of the great toys we have this year. This is a Mickey Mouse who dances and sings to you. Now, you can't tell me, as cynical as you are, that you wouldn't like your own Mickey Mouse who dances and tells stories to you.
How are you doing this year over last? I mean, if we could just talk sales and recession and economy for a second.
Well, you know, toys tend to hold pretty well in a recession because when it comes to the Christmas season, the last thing parents want to cut back on is that Christmas present for their child.
So are you making money now?
We're pleased with how we're doing. We just came off Black Friday. We're sitting here in Times Square. There were approximately 1,500 people lined up outside the store when we opened for Black Friday at 10 p.m. on Thursday night. They stretched out that door, down Broadway, down 45th Street, across 6th Avenue. It took them almost 2 hours to even enter the store. So I invite you to come back here next Black Friday and enjoy the experience.
I wouldn't be caught dead, and I'm going to go back to you thinking I'm a horrible cynic here, but people lining up at 10 o'clock on a Thursday night at a toy store, does that make sense?
I think you're Scrooge. You need to look at the smiles on the faces of the people in the store. I've said this before, and it's true. Shopping is a form of recreation for people. They enjoy it. It's an opportunity to take everything we work for all year long, all that hard work and the money that we generate, and to turn it into something that provides additional value. So in this case, they're buying toys for their children.
Jerry Storch, Chairman and CEO of Toys R Us. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
There's more of my chat with Jerry Storch and conversations from other corner offices on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. By Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Putnam Investments, committed to helping families across America pursue their college savings goals, on the web at putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, nothing at all to do with unemployment, deficits, taxes, or toys. Instead, stories that didn't quite make the headlines, courtesy of Brendan Noonan, Rico Galliano, and the rest of the Marketplace staff.
John Haas, editor, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
There's a Japanese aquarium just outside of Tokyo that's going to power a 6-foot-tall Christmas tree with electric eels.
Really?
They're going to have the eels swim around, and there'll be aluminum plates that send the charge up through wires and light up the lights.
So there's all our environmental problems solved. We'll just power the grid with eels.
The Obama administration's already looking to find a nuclear-powered whale.
Stacey Vanek-Smith, senior reporter for Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, Brendan, the mansion from the Godfather movies where the Corleones lived is an actual mansion in Staten Island, and it's up for sale.
Really?
For $2.9 million. It's an 8-bedroom house.
So insert offer you can't refuse joke here, right?
You think this is funny?
No, Stacey.
Do I amuse you? Am I a joke to you?
Jennifer Collins, reporter, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
So maybe you've heard of the Kardashians. They're this reality show family. And they attached their name to this prepaid debit card earlier this year. It was aimed at young adults, their fans. Problem is, earlier this week, they took their names off this card.
Why?
There are these really high fees associated with the card, so it was considered predatory. Like $100 a year if you keep it.
This is for a prepaid card?
Yeah, the Connecticut Attorney General is looking into this.
This is just another blow to America's faith in its financial system. It's like, forget Bear Stearns. If we cannot trust the Kardashian name,
who can we trust?
That is just a tiny taste of what's on the menu on Rico and Brendan's podcast. It's called Dinner Party Download, and there is a link on our website, marketplace.org. But for now, that is Marketplace, the radio show from American Public Media. Today, the Dow added another 19 points, about a 10%. The NASDAQ gained just under a 0.5%, 12 points. The S&P 500 took home a 0.25%, about 3 points. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Ewer. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, fighting foreclosure with paperwork.
The way I see it, you want more papers? Fine. I'll give you an office full of papers if that's what you want. But we're staying there.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourself a great weekend. We'll be back here on Monday.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.